you're very welcome to the 99%.
You're Michael McAndrew.
And you're Lucien Waugh Daly.
And we're very delighted to be here today for the very first episode of our brand new podcast. Isn't this an exciting day, Michael?
This is... I thought this day would never come.
Yeah, seriously.
Because it's been just this huge build-up of,
Since March,
yeah,
we've been trying to get the 99% going on the road, and finally now, we've got the brakes, we've got the engine, we've got the radio, and we've got the air freshener. And everything's just going great.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
You know, it's an exciting day for everybody.
Yeah, absolutely.
So we're here today in 99% HQ.
World Headquarters.
And we have
a
studio audience. Hey, guys.
Hi.
Supposed to clap.
Yeah, we have a small but important studio audience here to witness our very first episode.
Yeah, it's very small. It's three guys.
So, Michael, how has your day been?
My day's been really interesting because we recorded the finale of the Talks About Tech Weekly podcast, a podcast that I used to do for 4 years, and I stopped September 1st was the last episode, 2014. So you wanted to wrap it up. You said, if I don't do this show, you're going to do it.
Yeah, I threatened you.
You threatened me.
It was like proper ISIS level threat.
So I had to do it. So we all got on the show. We got Owen Dobie, who's sitting over there right now.
Kevin McAndrew, Barrett Convery, Shane Kelly.
Yeah, we got the whole gang together, and we did a finale, and it was fantastic.
So today's first episode of the 99% is going to be really exciting. We are joined today by special guest Graham Smith, the CEO of Republic, an organization who are trying to get the monarchy abolished in Britain.
Right.
Graham's appeared on television, radio, and been in the media a lot, and we have him joining us later on in the
great
show.
Guest.
We're going to be talking about some major topics. We're going to talk about social media legacies. What happens to our social media accounts after we die? We're going to be discussing the 2015 Glastonbury Festival, the crazy tax returns of Universal Studios, the Apple Watch, and in just a moment we'll be talking about some of the US presidential candidates.
Right. This is going to be a very interesting episode. Yeah, we're kind of messing around. We don't, like, I personally don't know where the show's exactly going to go yet. We're kind of testing to
but it's
going to
go somewhere awesome.
Yeah, absolutely. So I guess the first thing that we're going to get asked is, like, what's with the 99%? I mean, what the hell does that mean? Yeah,
well, you may have heard the expression the 99% before the 99%, the 1%, you know, it was a big thing during the sort of Occupy Wall Street movement, whenever that began to happen, 2009, 2010. Sort of the 99% is sort of everybody in society that does not own the top, whatever, 5% of the wealth.
Yeah.
And so we wanted to do a show about, you know, society and about culture, that about everybody everywhere. And the best way to do it is to condense it into the show, the 99%. We're going to have, we're going to talk about, you know, culture, technology, politics, news, all sorts of stuff that affects people in the 99%. And, you know, it sounds broad, but we're going to try and make it, you know, entertaining and consistent and just really an interesting show.
I guess we'll see where it takes us.
We will. Did you know, Michael, I've got a statistic here for you.
All right.
You know, 99% of people who download the first episode of a podcast stop listening after 4 minutes.
I did not know that.
Well, it's
true. Is that true? Is it actually true?
It's. Well, I think it's true.
That, I mean, it's pretty
so
obvious.
So all of our listeners just went.
Yeah.
Okay. 99%.
Well, I guess. I mean, that's why YouTube. That's why YouTube videos are so popular.
Exactly.
It's because
short,
they're so
concise.
Short. Like, people don't, especially nowadays, people don't have enough time.
I mean, if you're listening to us now, if you're in your home, then that's interesting because you're giving up much time.
I mean, even for me, I only ever listen to podcasts when I'm doing something else.
Yeah, well, if you're on a bus or something.
Sure, or when I'm working away doing something.
Thing is, right now, you could be looking at this episode and you can see the running time and you're thinking, geez, that's a long episode.
Yeah.
We don't know how long it's going to be, but
it's probably going to be around an hour.
You could be thinking, well, I don't know, a whole hour of podcasting with just these boring guys? I mean, but we tell you, you stick around for the hour, there's going to be some fun. We're going to have a lot of fun before the end of the show today.
All right. You got any more stats for me?
I'll have some later on in the episode.
Okay.
I can promise you that.
Fair enough. I like the stats.
We're going to start off today with some current affairs.
Oh, fun stuff.
Very big day last Friday in the United States. Because officially now, the US has gay marriage for everyone.
Yeah, well, Ireland bet them to it.
But, you know, America is now...
Ireland's great.
America's, you know, pretty great too. Not as great.
Well, I was just in America.
You were just in California. Michael, you...
the audience don't like that.
You returned home last Friday. You missed the Supreme Court's gay marriage ruling by like an hour.
Well, yeah.
It was bad luck.
Well, here's the thing. So, I was on the plane. I was on the plane from England to Ireland, I think, when I got in.
Oh, right.
I got a tweet when I was in Heathrow. You saying it, so that's when it broke.
But you are officially
missed the pride parade.
But you're one of the last people in the history of the United States to visit the United States as a tourist, to fly away on a plane while it was still an unequal country for gay people. Like, is a cool thing to put up on your wall on a certificate.
I don't know if it's something to brag about. it's definitely true. I never actually thought of it that way. But, it was kind of... And then, the day after... I hear on the news there was a shooting in San Francisco, and I was literally in San Francisco the day before that, 2 days before that happened. That's pretty scary. Did you hear about that? There was
I saw that they were having the pride parade.
Yeah, it was actually not related to the parade in any way, shape, or form.
Yeah, it was just in the area.
There was some teenagers, and then gathered around. They were fighting, and they shot some shots, and people were injured. No one died.
No, it wasn't fatal. Yeah.
And I think that's why it didn't make massive news because nobody died. But yeah, that's pretty crazy stuff.
So the Supreme Court's ruling came, and basically America is for the moment an equal country in terms of marriage, not in terms of lots of other things, but in terms of marriage it is, and it's pretty great.
Yeah, absolutely.
So the other big thing last week was the Charleston shooting, and this was a tragedy, but afterwards President Obama gives this amazing eulogy at the church, and he sings Amazing Grace, and then he gets really excited, and it was moving, and it was the kind of speech from President Obama that I wish he'd been doing for the last 4 years, the last 6 years.
Well, I mean, I guess he couldn't. He can't really do that as president.
It's just
on a daily basis.
Because when he first ran for president, there was such a momentum surrounding him, and he was just this energetic, cool guy.
That's
and
very true.
I think we saw that energy and that passion come out last week for the first time in a and also the way he addressed the Supreme Court's ruling on gay marriage as well. He had so much passion about him, and it was really it was inspiring, and he hasn't been like that in the media for quite a while, and it was great to see him back and forth.
I think though that he can't, it suits the role of president more if he takes a more kind of he's not if he doesn't get
worked up about things
in his speeches and stuff.
Speaking of the President of the United States, election time is almost here. Election time is almost here. Yeah, it's 17 months away, and we're already deep in the heated moment. There are a whole bunch of candidates currently running. I'm not going to list them out because that would be boring. The ones who matter at all on the left, we have Hillary, and we have Bernie Sanders and Mike O'Malley. Then on the right, we've got Jeb Bush and Donald Trump. And there's a few other guys.
Donald Trump is the big guy.
A few other guys who matter, like Scott Walker and Marco Rubio and Chris Christie. Chris Christie will get to first. He's the most recent to have announced his campaign. His announcement was on Monday. We both watched it.
I mean, I watched part of it.
Yeah,
I couldn't say I watched the whole thing.
Can't say I was very happy at the end. What did you think of Chris Christie's speech? You don't have a lot of experience of watching Chris Christie, do you?
No, not at all. I didn't even hear about him.
Yeah.
No. He's just like a normal politician. I mean, that's what they do. They go out and they say that they're going to do this.
Because Chris Christie thinks he's different.
Yeah.
He says, I'm telling it like it is. I'm honest. I'm Chris Christie.
Okay.
And he's not. He's the same as everyone else.
Yeah.
And he's not a very good speaker. And he doesn't seem to be getting the kind of enthusiasm from the public that he expects. But I was disappointed with his speech. Like, frankly, I expected him to say more.
Just typical speech.
Things I'd agree with. He didn't really say anything. I
wouldn't
expect any Republican to be somebody I'd support, but definitely him more than others. But no, in fact, I think...
I'm not against him. Yeah. What a lot of what he thinks and stuff is...
Sure. And of course, then we have Trump, who at first seemed like a joke. I mean, it seemed like he wouldn't even be worth discussing. But he's actually become a legitimate contender. Came second in a poll last week of all the Republican candidates in New Hampshire.
It's a poll, though.
Which is terrifying. Because he is really an awful, awful person. He says Mexicans, they bring drugs, they bring crime, and they rape our women. He has no respect for minorities.
Oh my god.
But I'll tell you, and he says, nobody does war bigger and better than me. That's what he said. Now, Donald Trump, I mean, there's some interesting things people might not know about him.
Donald Trump
donated money to Hillary Clinton in 2008. He donated money to her campaign. Yeah. And he is, he's pro-life. That's his, you know, he has a pro-life abortion stance. Huh. And he, you know, he's got some pretty liberal leanings in other areas too, which I was surprised by. But I mean, that doesn't really matter in the grand scheme of things when he literally wants to kick all Mexicans out of America because he thinks that they're rapists. I mean, he has no integrity and is really an awful person. And he's actually running for president, so we can all get excited for that campaign. We don't know if he's going to be let into the debates yet. He said a big controversy the last week. He said a falling out with NBC. They've pulled his pageants, and it looks like it won't be long before Celebrity Apprentice is no longer on that network. If it is already on, I think it might be on Fox. I have no idea. So, yeah, those are... that's Republican Watch for this week.
Yeah.
So we took a quiz, didn't we, Michael?
You told me to take this quiz. What's the quiz?
iSideWith.com.
Yeah.
This quiz is getting a lot of traction in the media because it's very accurate.
Yeah, it's pretty cool.
I mean, I wouldn't say accurate, but, you know, it gives you a very good representation of who you would be voting for.
I recommend everybody to go out and take this quiz right now.
iSideWith.com. So we both took the quiz, and we both got Bernie Sanders.
Right.
Who is, you know, the pretty... I guess he's, like, the furthest left candidate of the Democratic Party. Certainly in terms of some of his policies, he's more left-wing than Hillary, but, you know, it's America.
I was 94%.
I was 92%.
I think I saved it.
It was 92%. I have a graph here, actually, of who I got, and I'll tell you my results if anyone would care to know. I'm not sure if they would. So, you know... When my results came out, Sanders was my number one by quite a bit. Then we have Clinton. Then we have O'Malley, quite a bit down. O'Malley's the third Democratic candidate. I'm not a huge fan of O'Malley. O'Malley, his policies are very steeped in his religion, from what I can tell. And I don't know, I wouldn't be inclined to support someone of that nature. But he has done great things in Baltimore. He's done great things for minorities. He's done great things for achieving same-sex marriage. So, you know, he's a good candidate.
Uh-huh.
Then next up on my list, we have Jeb Bush, who, as I said, is pretty much just about my favorite Republican who's running. And then we have Rand Paul. Now, remember a few weeks ago, Michael, I showed you Rand Paul's video where it was an anti-Hillary video about defeating the Washington machine, which showed a sort of nuclear apocalypse vision of Washington, D.C.
Yeah.
Rand Paul. So he's a very he's a reactionary extremist.
Yeah.
But somehow I agree with him on a lot of policies, primarily social policies. Who knows how that works? And with Jeb Bush, my main thing is on education and environment. So do you have your results there?
Yeah, I was trying to look for them.
So you got Bernie and Hillary and O'Malley.
Okay, so from what I can remember, I can't find the thing. From what I can remember, I was... 60% Hillary.
Okay.
60% in agreement with Hillary. 94% with
Bernie.
I can't remember who else.
Yeah, I got like 82. I got about
looking for it here now.
I got about 82%. 82% Hillary, which is more than I would have expected. But my lowest of all of the candidates, Trump. Yeah. Trump was not included in this. Because he hadn't declared at this point, was Rick Perry. Now, Rick Perry is an interesting guy because Rick Perry, at his campaign launch, he played a song. And what he played was a remix of this song. He played a remix of this song by Colt Ford called Answer to No One. It's sort of this sort of country rap song. And I'm gonna play you some of his version of the song here now in a minute. Because Rick Perry apparently thinks that Rick Perry apparently thinks that playing remixes of country rap songs is the way that he's going to win the young people of America over to his.
Oh yes, I found the.
Over to his. Okay, so tell us.
Okay, well, while you're getting that up, I was. Let me see here. 94% Bernie Sanders. 71% Hillary Clinton. And crazy as it may seem, 64% Jeb Bush.
Yeah.
56% Martin O'Malley. 25% Scott Walker. 25% Ben Carson. 17% Rand Paul. 8% Carly
Fiorina.
Fiorina. And 4% Ted Cruz.
Okay. I got really low. I got like 2-3% for Cruz and Fiorina. Ted Cruz.
5% Rick Perry.
Ted Cruz and.
Ted Cruz, 4%.
Cruz and Carson both deny climate change and think that the devil is controlling American politics. This is Rick Perry's campaign song. Let's look at a little clip of it here.
All right.
Please welcome my husband, Rick Perry.
So, Rick Perry has this, you know, quality country rap song.
It's unreal.
It's a remix of a song by Cold Ford called Answer to No One. I've actually listened to the song
I think I heard it.
I listened to the song a bunch over the last few weeks. I actually kind of like it. It's a pretty catchy, it's a catchy tune.
But the lyrics are like...
The lyrics are seriously dodging. the song includes lyrics, you know, take my job but not my gun.
Yeah.
You know, shotgun toter Republican voter. My right to vote, my right to toast, the weapon of my choice, don't censor my voice. So, extremely right-wing song. He wants to keep immigrants out and bear his weapon, basically. Big fan of the Fifth Amendment. Yeah. Rick Perry is. So he got this remix of the Cold Ford song anyway. And Rick Perry is the candidate, which was I had least in common. And I am delighted to be able to announce that in public.
I think Ted Cruz was...
Ted Cruz is
1% less for me.
Ted Cruz is clinically insane.
5%. Okay, it's good for me then. 5% Rick Perry for me. So
nice one.
There you go.
So yeah, presidential election not till next November.
I highly recommend you take the I side with.
Yeah.
Did
any members of our studio audience get a result in the last few minutes?
Yeah, Barra said that his was really dodgy.
He said it was Bernie,
but he
didn't agree on college fees. But if you agreed on everything else, then it would still. I mean, I don't.
Similar to other things, he also said like America should get involved. Bernie Sanders should get involved in Iraq. Was that Bernie Sanders?
No, Bernie Sanders is totally anti-war.
Okay, I was wondering. Yeah, because
Bernie Sanders is trying to appeal to sort of older white men, but also to young people. He's got an interesting demographic. I mean, Hillary has, like, all women going for her. So that's an advantage in the Democratic primaries.
Well, I mean, I would vote for Hillary.
Bernie Sanders got 10,000 people at a campaign event this week, while Hillary, at her launch, only got something like 4,500. So Bernie's really getting momentum, but he's not going to catch up with Hillary. He just isn't. But, you know, I like Bernie. But obviously, if it came down to Hillary versus Jeb... I'd go with Hillary.
Definitely.
Yeah, so that's a bit of politics
right on
the show. We'll have some more later when we do some public service announcements at the end of the show.
All right, I think we should talk tech.
I think we should talk tech.
Let's talk tech. So, I was in America recently.
Were you, Michael? Were you in America recently?
I was in California recently.
And in the summer of all times.
And so, one of the things you do when one is in America, because in... the little country that we live in, also known as Ireland, we don't have any Apple stores at all.
We have
Apple stores. We have CompuB.
Okay, that's not an Apple store.
That's not an Apple store. It looks kind of like one,
but
it's
not an
Apple
store.
So
be very wary. It is not an Apple store.
Yeah, it's an Apple reseller. Yeah. So naturally, the first thing we were to do was go to a shopping mall and visit an Apple store.
Very nice.
We walk in anyway, and Mom and Dad were with myself and Kevin, and I think it was probably a really bad idea to bring Mom into the Apple store, because I was telling Mom about this Apple Watch. She was like, I don't really like it, you know, and I was kind of selling the Apple Watch to her.
Accidentally?
I was giving a bad impression of it. I was saying, it's not really that great. I wouldn't buy one. They're really expensive. I don't know why anybody's buying one.
Slander.
Which is, yeah, definitely slanderous. Which is not actually my opinion.
Yeah.
I was just saying it to my mom. But anyway, yeah, so we went into the Apple store, and straight away my mom went over to the Apple Watch they have this really nice kind of a desk, a glass desk, where they had a gold, they had the 38 and 42 mil Apple watches. They had the really, really nicely laid out. And my mom said, oh, that looks kind of nice. How much is one? And I said $350. She was like, that's pretty expensive. So I went off looking at the new MacBook, which is it's really expensive. I mean, anything Apple is really expensive, but it's really thin. And people are like, well, the new MacBook is like a revolution, which I don't agree with, because that netbook right there was pretty much the exact same thing as the MacBook. But so I was overlooking at the new MacBooks, and all of a sudden Dad comes over. He's like, oh, your mother is buying an Apple Watch.
Oh, no.
So she, the girl, like, brought her over, and they had, like, it was like a jewelry. They have, like, set it up like a jewelry store. So yep. you get your Apple Watch fitted and stuff.
Oh,
and so she was trying on the 38 mil and the 42 mil and whatever. So she bought an Apple Watch. And so, thankfully, I've gotten a lot of time to play with the Apple Watch and to kind of make up my own decision. My dad also bought one, 42 mil Apple Watch Sport. And, yeah, so I've gotten the chance to play with both the 38 mil and the 42 mil. And I have to say my opinion has changed slightly. I was a little bit skeptical about the Apple Watch when I first heard about it, because I felt like there was no need for it. But it's kind of like every Apple product. When the iPhone first came out, most people thought, I have absolutely no need for this phone at all. And when the iPad came out, it's like, what would I use a tablet for? But when you get one, you actually start using it, and you discover the power of it. So I was, again, very skeptical with the Apple Watch. But,
and now you can't live without your Apple Watch.
Well, I don't have one. But my dad is of that opinion. He says, you know, I can't live without my Apple Watch now. He loves it. He really does. It does have its quirks. I guess, design-wise, it feels like every Apple product. It's a really, really premium product. It fits really nice on the wrist. And that's what differentiates it most between all of the other products, all of the other Android Wear watches on the market. So I also tried the Moto 360, which is like the direct competitor to the Apple Watch running Android Wear, which would be the watch that I would get if I was interested, because I have an Android phone.
Mm-hmm.
And it didn't feel as high quality as the Apple Watch does. That is really the main thing. But so probably what I found the most useful was the fitness, the fitness stuff. So it has a heart rate monitor on it, so it'll tell your heart rate at any given moment, which is very, very useful if you're into fitness and that. There, obviously, it counts your steps. It, you know, will tell you calories that you burned, tracks you throughout the day. Now, I mean, it's something that I can also do on my phone, but ultimately, where it comes in most useful is if I want to go on a run and I don't want to bring my phone with me. I don't have anywhere to put my phone. I can just keep my watch on, plug in some Bluetooth earphones, start listening to music, and it'll track my run for me.
Yeah.
I don't have to bring my phone with me at all. Super useful there. Notifications. I have to say, Apple have never handled notifications well. Android is fantastic with notifications, the way that it's all handled in the notifications bar.
Yeah.
Apple tried to copy Android exactly, and they still managed to mess it up. So, but the way that they handle, I mean, even on the Apple Watch, it's not as good as Android, but it's really useful to be able to, if you get a notification, instead of your phone buzzing in your pocket and making a bit of noise, it just kind of taps you.
Yeah.
It just taps you on the
wrist. Oh, right. Yeah,
it's like a pulse. You kind of feel it on your wrist. So it doesn't actually make any noise or vibrate on your hand or anything. You just kind of feel it when you get a notification. You have a look and you can see, oh, it's a text message from someone or someone's ringing me. You can pick up the call on the spot. You can tell them to that you ring them back later or whatever. You can dictate, so you can dictate text messages, whatever. You can use Siri. You can do all that stuff straight from your watch without having to take your phone out of your pocket. Now, it might seem like a very small thing, but in everyday life, it becomes very useful. I However, I still don't think that Apple definitely have not gotten this right. The interface is extremely difficult to use. It took my mom quite a long time to get used to it. Same with my dad. The kind of the tiny little icon thing is just ridiculous.
Yep.
It's almost as ridiculous as the balls in Apple Music.
Yeah.
The digital crown is fantastic, but it's not consistent. So in some applications, the digital crown does one thing. In other applications, it doesn't do anything at all. And in other applications, it does something completely different.
Yeah.
So, you know, you need a manual. It feels that the software, the software feels very much like a beta product.
Yeah.
And that's what I kind of expected. So I wasn't too disappointed there. But Apple have already announced their WatchOS 2 mm-hmm. at WWDC, and that should be coming out this autumn. And that should fix a lot of the problems. It does have 8 gigabytes of storage built in, which means that what they're going to start doing now is loading apps straight onto the watch. At the moment, what they're doing is they're actually streaming apps from the phone onto the watch. So you might notice that they're a bit slow, sluggish running. That's because they're not local on the watch. So once they get that done, make some interface improvements, I think it's a pretty decent product. It's not going to get me moving away from my Casio watch.
Yeah.
It's not going to get me moving back to iOS because I love Android. Yeah. But, I mean, you tried it out today.
I tried it out. While. Didn't like it.
Yeah.
It just seemed lame.
Well, I mean, you have
don't
to...
Don't want one.
Yeah, you have to you have to take a little bit more time to get
and you have to
use
you have
it everyday
to actually
life.
Try putting it to practical use. So if you go running with it, I'm sure I'd be like, oh, this is actually pretty neat.
Right. But, I mean, there's better devices that do that running thing. They'll do the running thing and they'll do it better than... Or they'll do the same thing as the Apple Watch for fitness.
Yeah.
They'll do like the Fitbit, for example. It does fitness. It does the exact same thing as the Apple Watch, fitness-wise.
Yeah.
It doesn't have as much functionality as the Apple Watch. It doesn't, you know, have that lovely interface and stuff. But for fitness, it's the best thing, and you can buy one for $50, you know. So it depends on what you're going to use it for. Personally, though, you know, I thought I wasn't going to like it, and I liked it more than I thought I was. You know, that's my opinion on it anyway. So.
All right. Apple Watch. And,
yeah. Apple Watch.
Apple also launched Apple Music this week. We're not going to go into that in great detail, but,
I mean,
you can hear about it over on Talks About Tech Weekly.
Sure. We covered it on the finale, of Talks About Tech Weekly. And,
You might talk about it next week if we get a better sense of it.
I've only tried it out for a little while, so I want to have a little bit more time to talk about it in greater detail on this show. But it's basically Spotify.
Yeah.
Spoiler alert. That's it. Do we move on? Yeah.
Move on to some entertainment?
Sure.
So this is my main man, Kanye West. I respect his energy, if nothing else. So this is him at Glastonbury Saturday night doing a black skinhead. Give it a sec now and we get a nice appearance from the renowned British comedian Lee Nelson. Here we go. Kanye doesn't like this at all.
That was it.
Wasn't really worth showing. Alright, cut that out.
Kanye West,
so,
folks, he's in the building. Yo, yo.
The guy started singing Bohemian Rhapsody.
So,
yeah, he tried singing Bohemian
Rhapsody. So Kanye tried singing Bohemian Rhapsody. It really didn't work. He kind of abandoned it.
That was terrible.
I mean, his whole set was... really just a total mess.
I mean, Kanye West is a delusional character.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if...
You want to get up a mic?
I don't know if he actually thinks that people like him. I mean, like, I know people do like him,
he's
obviously.
He's definitely driven by money.
I don't... Oh, absolutely. But, I mean, I think more than anything, he's just driven by ego. He thinks that he's the best. And no one else, not even his wife, I don't think, thinks that he's the best, because he's not, and to think he was would be a clear sign of madness.
Rap is the new rock and roll, Lucien.
Well, he says he's the greatest rock and roll star in the world.
Yeah. I think that... wait, did Pete Townsend, like, hint?
Pete Townsend sort of said it.
I saw that.
Pete Townsend was like, let's see who's really the greatest rock and roll star.
So I was like,
you're saying it now. This guy, look at him. Here we go. Beautiful singing.
He lets the crowd do all the heavy lifting.
He does. Oh, he's such a...
Like, the crowd are singing it way better than he is. Like, that's all you need to know.
I think we've heard enough of that. It's really headache inducing. I mean,
when you run on.
Oh no, that was long after it.
Oh my god!
I mean, if you want to hear, fantastic. This is an actual decent singer right here. Is this man is a better singer than Kanye West?
Wow! Who is this man?
I don't know. It's the president.
President of the U.S.
The president of the U.S. who is employed as a politician. When he's a better singer than somebody who headlines the Glastonbury Festival as a musician, you know something's fucking wrong with the Glastonbury Festival.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Wow, that's pretty legendary.
So Obama, you know, I talked about this earlier. He's a pretty great singer. Anyway, back to the Glastonbury Festival. So we had The Who this year. We had Kanye. We had Foo Fighters. Oh, no, we didn't because there was an accident. So Florence and the Machine played. And a really mediocre festival. And, watching it on television is no longer an interesting... watching the Glastonbury Festival on television is no longer an interesting event in the musical calendar.
I watched The Who. I thoroughly enjoyed The Who. I thought The Who were great.
But they're always great.
I mean, they're always great.
They didn't surprise me.
Yeah.
I mean, I was predictably impressed by their work.
See, I love The Who.
I love The Who.
And, you know, I've been listening to Florence and Machine, their latest album. What's it called again?
So Big, So Bright.
Yes.
So Beautiful.
So Big, Blue, So Blue.
Big, So Blue, So Beautiful.
Yeah, whatever it is. And I actually really like it. The band are incredible.
Mm.
Her as a singer, I have mixed opinions about.
Yep.
She has a very distinctive voice, and I think that's her defining... I don't think she's a good... I don't think she's a fantastic singer. But I'm thoroughly enjoying their new album. And I never really listened to Florence and the Machine before when they got big in 2009.
Yeah.
I mean, they were a very small band. It's the BBC that made them big.
Yeah, really.
I think it was actually Zane Lowe, wasn't it? Like,
probably.
He was like playing their music. He was like a huge fan of them. And that's...
Probably, yeah.
I didn't actually watch their Glastonbury performance, but I've been enjoying their latest album.
Uh-huh.
I never watched Glastonbury.
Yeah. I've been watching it since I was a small child, like every year, and it's always been an impressive festival. I mean, 2009, you had Neil Young on Friday, Bruce Springsteen on Saturday.
Wow.
That was a great festival.
Yeah.
Then you had, it's gotten worse every year. I mean, then you had a year when it was, Gorillaz, Muse, and Stevie Wonder. I mean, that was fine. Then you had a year when it was the Rolling Stones, Arcade Fire. That was a pretty good year.
Oh, that would be good.
That was a good year. But then you had last year, it was, what was it, Mumford & Sons, Kasabian, and Metallica. Blink-182 would not be, they weren't headlining anyway. They might have been on in the afternoon. But, I mean, geez, it's just not a headline festival anymore. I mean, Springsteen and Neil Young the same year in a weekend.
That's
and Blur. So, other entertainment news. Universal Studios have had the greatest year of basically any film studio ever. I mean, they went from being the bottom of the barrel of studios to this year having a crazy good year. It started off at 50 Shades of Grey. Big hit for them.
Serious movie.
Big hit for them. Then they had Furious 7, which is now the third biggest movie of all time. Then they had a bunch
Wait. The third biggest.
Furious 7 is now the biggest movie of all time not directed by James Cameron.
Oh my god.
Yeah.
That's mad.
They definitely planned for the killing of Yeah,
Furious 7 is a crazy hit, right? Because it's so big in China. and in countries like that, where, you know, Hollywood films have really only gotten big the last few years.
Oh, yeah.
And then they had, after that, they had you know, they had a couple of smaller hits like Pitch Perfect 2, and then now they've had Jurassic World, which broke the, which had the biggest US opening weekend of all time, the biggest worldwide opening weekend of all time, mm-hmm. and was the fastest film ever to reach $1 billion worldwide, and it's mm-hmm. just done crazy.
We'll see when Star Wars comes out.
I don't think Star Wars is going to best these films. I think Jurassic World has a wider appeal than Star Wars, yeah. because I think Star Wars, while it is so beloved and so anticipated amongst cinema fans and sci-fi fans, I think that Jurassic World has a greater appeal just with people who don't usually go to see films. You know, people who don't go to the cinema, and they usually probably choose to watch TV. And they think, oh, Jurassic Park, that is a franchise I remember from a child, and it's more accessible and it has broader appeal than something that's slightly more... you know, specifically sci-fi in tone as Star Wars is.
Right.
I'm calling it now. Star Wars ain't gonna surpass these films.
Here, what did he say about Obamacare in this?
In the first 6 months of Universal's year, they've had some of the... They've had basically the two or three biggest films of the year so far, excluding the Avengers 2. And, well, their tax returns for the first half of 2015 will be... very, very large. So it's time now for our very special guest on this week's episode, and that is Mr. Graham Smith. Graham Smith is the CEO of Republic, an organization in the UK who are trying to abolish the monarchy, trying to achieve the abolition of the monarchy and replace them with an elected head of state.
Yeah.
They are, you know, they're running several very high-profile campaigns. Graham has appeared on BBC News, CNN, and more. He's been on many major media debates. And mm-hmm. they are a very interesting organization. So we spoke to Graham earlier, and here's how we got on. We're joined now by Graham Smith, the CEO of Republic, an organization who are aiming to replace the British monarchy with an elected head of state. Republic's website states that three things must be kept in mind in relation to the monarchy. The monarchy is a political institution steeped in power and vested interest. There is no evidence that the monarchy is good for tourism or a benefit to the UK economy, and broadcasters have a duty to report the monarchy impartially and in the same manner they would report any other political issue. So, Graham, tell us, just how damaging is the continuing role of the monarchy to Britain's democratic integrity at the moment?
Well, the monarchy is a central part of our political system. It's not just a decorative institution. It goes beyond just the Queen going around opening things and waving at people. You know, it is, our political system is centered on the Crown. The Crown is the source of political power in this country, and that power is exercised either by Parliament or by the Prime Minister. And when it's exercised by Parliament, it's exercised usually at the instruction or direction of the Prime Minister. So, you know, the cumulative effect of having a monarchy is the concentration and centralisation of power in Downing Street, in the hands of the government. And the monarchy, as in terms of the royals and the, you know, the princes and princesses and the weddings and so on, is very useful to politicians, because it then acts as a kind of a veil for that power structure.
Okay. A way in which the British monarchy sort of recently affected us personally was that Charles and Camilla made a visit to the city we live in, Galway, a pretty high-profile visit. Yeah. And the part of this that was most covered in the media was a meeting between Charles and the Sinn Féin leaders, Gerry Adams and Martin McGuinness. And, you know, I felt that this was treated very much as a political milestone, which really just proved that Charles and that the monarchy are a political institution, as you say, because, you know, technically a political meeting should have been held between the British Prime Minister or somebody in the actual government with, you know, the Irish politicians with whom they've had a difficult relationship. But so, you know, Charles was acting as a political figure in this situation.
Yeah, I mean, I think that visit and that meeting was part of the ongoing process of, you know, sort of mending relationships and, you know, putting the conflict behind us. I think that, you know, on that occasion, the you know, the royals are seen as sort of symbolic of the UK side, if you like, of that conflict, and so it is. there's a heightened symbolism having Charles meet leaders of Sinn Féin rather than politicians. So I think on that occasion, you know, I could understand why they did that, but I think that clearly, you know, Charles and Camilla did that because they were asked to by the politicians, and they are often asked to do these things.
Yeah. I just would have preferred if the politicians themselves had made the visit. I would have, you know, thought that was a more symbolic event, even than just having these sort of token figures as they are sort of.
Yeah, and I take that point. And I think there is there is an important point there that you know, the bottom line is that the, you know, the royal family should not be symbolic of any of this, and you know, the people that do represent Britain when we do try to do these things, such as mending relationships and building bridges, should be those who are accountable and who are genuinely representing the country. Because ultimately, the Windsors, I mean, a lot was said about the fact that Mountbatten was killed by the IRA back in the 70s, and it was a kind of a personal event for Charles. And it was all about that and not about the two countries building bridges. And I think that was the opportunity that was missed by having Prince Charles sort of representing this country, because what he was really doing was representing
himself
and his family, as if somehow the attack on the British state, as it were, was an attack on them personally, and somehow that was more important than the British people and the British state. And I think that's unfortunate. I think it would be, generally speaking, with it, not just on this occasion, but on any occasion, it's far more powerful when you have elected representatives meeting each other than people who really don't have any claim to be there or to represent anybody.
Yeah. And in terms of their political and their symbolic roles and the contrast between those, how do you think the current state of the British monarchy compares to a few other remaining monarchies, in developed countries around the world?
In developed countries, there aren't too many of them left. But, in Europe, and they're very similar. I mean, there's not a lot of difference between the British monarchy and the Danish monarchy or the Swedish monarchy, for example. They have very similar positions in terms of their constitutional functions. Ours is more embedded in the constitution. Particularly the northern European countries that have monarchies have written constitutions, and they have much clearer limitations on the role of the crown, for example. But I think that, you know, obviously the British monarchy is much more high profile and much more ostentatious, and I think that our entire political system is a lot further behind those other countries. So it becomes more symbolic of that sort of antiquated nature of the British political system.
Okay.
I mean, compared to northern European countries, our political system is really, really flawed and you know, bordering on the undemocratic.
So Republic's major goal is to have the monarchy replaced with a more democratically elected system. And Republic has a very progressive and diplomatic strategy to achieve this. So what is your ideal vision for how Britain will kind of reach this point in the next decade or two where it will this change will actually occur?
Well, it has to happen through a referendum. I mean, there's no way we're going to do it without a referendum.
But is there not some sort of vicious circle where a referendum cannot be had with the monarchy as a sort of obstacle there?
No, the monarchy can't stop a referendum on the monarchy.
Okay.
It's not possible.
Yeah.
Parliament is sovereign in Britain, which is a problem. I mean, it shouldn't be sovereign. The people should be sovereign. But the very least, the monarch isn't sovereign. And the monarch, you know, the crown... is, as I said, that's the source of power, but that power was taken from, you know, the crown was taken from the monarch back in 1689 and was placed in Parliament. So basically, if we win the support of the public and if the politicians decide that, yeah, this is something we ought to do, there's nothing to stop Parliament from allowing a referendum to take place and then changing the constitution. So that's absolutely doable.
Right. So, Graham, I think a lot of people in the UK kind of think that the monarchy is kind of a fairly harmless celebrity machine who kind of keep the public spirits up. Do you see the monarchy as that, or do you think that their political influence is kind of a cost to the taxpayer and that kind of thing?
Well, I think it's true that a lot of people think that they are a harmless sort of extension of entertainment news, really. Yeah. And I think that that's a fairly substantial myth that needs to be challenged. I think that most people in the country might see them like that, but don't really care about them, and certainly aren't interested in their weddings and jubilees and trips to Ascot. I mean, the reality is that, you know, separate out the crown from the royals. That these are two sort of sides of the same coin. But the crown is absolutely part of the political system.
Yeah, absolutely.
It is absolutely the spine, the heart of the British Constitution, and it is through the exercise of crown powers that the government governs on a routine basis. Whether it's, you know, making appointments, whether it's making laws through the Privy Council, whether it's you know, exercising powers to go to war and that sort of thing, and signing treaties. So there's considerable power in the crown, and as I said, the royals are kind of the other side of that coin, and they're used to deflect demands for getting rid of the crown. You know, if you imagine we had the crown without the royal family, then people would see it for what it is. You know, it would be this this kind of skeleton without its clothing, and people kind of say, well, actually, that's not an acceptable way of running a country. Mm-hmm. In terms of the royals, they are, you know, they do have substantial influence and opportunity to influence. Now, they're not influencing economic policy or welfare policy, partly because they just couldn't care less about those things and wouldn't understand them if they did care. But I think that, you know, they have the opportunity to influence government on things they are interested in. And we've seen from Prince Charles's letters that he particularly, and I imagine the others too, routinely lobby ministers on things that do interest them. And this might be the armed forces, it might be hunting, agriculture, you know, the sorts of things you would expect large landowners and aristocratic people to take an interest in. And so they have that unique opportunity to, in secret, barring these two dozen letters that have been published, they have this opportunity in secret to lobby ministers. And they also have the opportunity to lobby ministers to defend their own interests. So they've had the freedom of information laws changed in their favour. They've had royal funding changed in their favour, and they've managed to, you know, ensure that the government doesn't do much to challenge their financial status or their privileges. So so you know, it is an institution that is, to put not too blunt a word on it, it is corrupt in the sense that if you define corruption as the abuse of public office for personal gain, then, you know, that is kind of the job description of being a royal. You know, that's what they do. And so, you know, in terms of feathering their own nest, you know, that is a real problem.
So you mentioned there their exemption from the Freedom of Information Act, which, you know, I find very troubling that any public official could achieve that. But also the British media are obligated, be it by Ofcom or by the BBC Trust, to enact, you know, complete political balance. And as you've pointed out previously, their coverage of the weddings and recently of the birth of the royal baby was not was completely biased coverage because the monarchy themselves are biased.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the monarchy is a political institution by definition. It is a political issue. You know, the whole when they're covering weddings and jubilees and royal babies, it raises a whole host of questions about why we have these people there in the first place. It raises questions about who genuinely supports it and is interested in it, and so on and so forth. And it's very the closest or the best analogy is probably the EU, which is, you know, another issue which I think certainly 15 years ago the anti-EU position was very much marginalised. It was a marginal issue and position, and there was a tendency among broadcasters to treat anti-EU people as being marginal. And there was a lot of work done to try and say, well, actually, you know, this is political and it needs to be treated in a sensible and impartial way. And the same is true with the monarchy. You know, they need to understand that it is political and they need to treat it accordingly. And I don't think it's a deliberate conspiracy on their part to promote the monarchy. I think most people within the broadcasters don't stop and think, oh, hang on a minute, we need to do this sensibly. The other thing is that they're terrified of being attacked by certain newspapers who would attack them if they're not seen to be duly deferential to the Queen. And I think that's a real shame because the, you know, the broadcasters have to stand up to those papers and say, well, you know, we have a duty of impartiality.
Right.
So when there's a baby or a wedding or jubilee, our job is to simply report that it's happening, to accurately reflect public interest, which they don't at all, and then to move on to more important stories.
So the Republic Conference for 2015 is coming up next week, right?
Yeah, July 11th. Yeah.
Right. Can you tell us a bit about that?
So we're going to be looking at royal expenses. We've got a new royal expenses report that just came out. So one of our investigators that helped put that report together is going to be looking at some of the information around that. So, you know, we worked out that the annual cost to the taxpayer for the monarchy was a third of £1 billion. Pounds. We're going to be announcing a new campaign to take the Duchy of Cornwall away from Prince Charles. We've got some guest speakers. We've got the deputy leader of the Green Party, Shara Ali, and the Sunday Times columnist, Tanya Gold, speaking as well. And it's really an opportunity for people, for supporters to come together and hear more about it, to get informed, get inspired, and have a good day sort of talking about this issue. And to go away, I think, as people often do go away from our conferences, left with the feeling that actually this is something which can happen, that we can actually succeed. You know, we're not, Republic is not about sitting around talking about this. We're very much focused on building a serious movement and achieving success.
Right. You just mentioned the Duchy of Cornwall there. Can you kind of talk a little bit about what that is?
Yeah, so the duchy is basically, I mean, it's been around for a long time, but it's basically a land portfolio turned business empire. And it's hereditary possession in the sense that it belongs to the crown.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, technically passes from one monarch to the next, and the monarch then allows, you know, appoints the heir to the throne as Duke of Cornwall.
Mm-hmm.
If the heir to the throne is a male, if it's a woman, then that's not the case. So the Queen was never the Duke of Cornwall. And the idea behind it is to provide an income to the heir to the throne. Quite why the taxpayer owes an income to the heir to the throne, I don't know. But there is this view that we do, and therefore they've provided the duchy to the heir to provide that income. And over the time that Charles has been Duke of Cornwall, which must be getting on for 50 years or 40 years, it has turned into a very large and powerful landowner and property empire, which the profits alone, I mean, the values are somewhere in the region of 100 million pounds. The profits each year are somewhere in the region of 19-20 million pounds, and that gets given to Charles without him paying, or without the duchy paying any tax on it first. So Prince Charles pays income tax on the profit, but the duchy pays no corporation tax, despite the fact that pretty much anybody who knows anything about the subject has said that shouldn't be the case.
So do you think there's a chance, sort of thinking optimistically, that were, you know, Queen Elizabeth to die and Charles was to take over as the monarch, would the public's attitude towards the monarchy become less positive in a short space of time?
I think there's a good chance that it will. I think that whether it's a short space of time or a longer space of time, I'm not, you know, it's harder to say. But I think that a huge amount of support for the monarchy is tied up with the Queen herself. A lot of that is fairly indifferent support. People don't really care that much. They don't have strong feelings about it. But they you know, when pushed, they think that the Queen is, you know, nice and they think that she hasn't done anything wrong and she's been there for as long as most of us can remember. And very few people can remember the last time we had a succession. And so it's just been part of that sort of background noise of living in Britain, really, that we've got the Queen. And there's this strong sense that, you know, it's somehow wrong to say anything bad about her and so on and so forth, which is in itself pretty appalling. I mean, you should be absolutely free to say what you like about the Queen.
Absolutely.
But the upshot of that is that it does leave them in potentially serious trouble if when Charles becomes king, because he just doesn't have that kind of respect or affection or even that kind of cloak of protection, you know, and deference that the Queen does. So, you know, it's going to be a completely different situation. But I think that just going through that transition is going to be fascinating, because it'll be the first time any of us will have experienced that, or most of us anyway. And and I think a lot of people in this day and age will be sitting there saying, well, hang on a minute, why have we just had a new head of state without bothering to have an election first? You know? And I think that's appalling. And I, you know, I was paying attention to the last elections for head of state in Ireland, and it was quite fascinating to watch. And I think that, you know, it's that kind of experience. Not just it's almost not so important who it is. It's the experience of going through that election, having that opportunity to have that election for someone who isn't going to be, you know, deciding economic policy or education policy, but someone who's just going to represent the nation. It's that experience that's missing. And I think that, you know, there's an opportunity to kind of make that point that, you know, this, when the Queen dies, there's, or when we get a chance to choose our next head of state, it should be up to the people to have that debate and decide who we want to represent.
Would you be worried at all, just one last question, would you be worried that if there was a actual democratic election for the head of state, people would be so used to having a sort of just passive, quiet person like Elizabeth as the head of state that they'd just vote for some, you know, sort of conservative candidate, some safe person who wasn't going to cause any trouble? And I mean, the president wouldn't have the opportunity to really, but a politician who sort of fits the same sort of archetype as the Queen.
I don't know. I suspect there may be some degree of that in the first election. I think that, but I think that, you know, the first thing that needs to be acknowledged is that if we have an election for head of state, that will only happen after we've already had a referendum in which we've debated all these issues and also gone into the ballot box and or gone into the polling booth and said, yes, we want to have that election. So when the election actually comes around, we're going to be taking that quite seriously. And the debate would have already been, you know, advanced a great deal in terms of what sort of head of state we're looking for. The other thing is that that would then be a contested election where, you know, the candidates would be putting themselves forward and seeking to win support. And I think that the thing about elections is that they are sometimes quite unpredictable. And the person that, you know, you might think, the sort of person you might think would win at the start of the election is very often not the person that then comes through and inspires people to vote for them by the end of the election. And I think that what we would find is someone who isn't necessarily divisive, but someone who is very eloquent and able to speak up in a way that actually impresses people. And I think that it would be someone that I think would impress most people.
Right. So, Graham, thank you very much for talking to us today. Thanks so much for taking some of your time out of your very busy schedule. So if people want to join the Republic movement, where can they find you on the internet?
Well, it's republic.org.uk. Very easy. And obviously we've got links to Twitter and Facebook on there as well.
Okay, great. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
So thanks very much again to Graham Smith for talking to us. Graham Smith is, of course, from Republic. All right. Lucian, you got some freedom rules.
Yeah, everybody. It's time now for my freedom rules.
Oh, yeah.
Are you excited for my freedom rules?
I am ready for this.
Okay.
What is this?
I don't have a lot of freedom rules. These are my freedom rules.
Okay.
Michael, these are some rights that you have. Because people love freedom in America. You have the freedom to stand naked in your doorway and whistle at everyone who walks past. But maybe you should write a philosophy book instead. Michael, you have the freedom to carry a gun in Toys R Us because you never know when a Tickle Me Elmo could threaten your family.
Okay.
Michael, yes, you have the freedom to hang upside down at a ceiling while people hit you with a stick, but your one-act play about the dangers of Mexican immigration isn't really going to appeal to mainstream audiences. Yes, Michael, you have the freedom to run for president, even if you are Donald Trump, but at least make an effort to top Rick Perry's campaign song.
I'm pretty sure I don't have the right to run for president because I'm not from America.
Oh, yeah. This song, Keep On Rocking by Neil Young, was actually Donald Trump's campaign song, and Neil Young has come out and said he's going to sue Donald Trump because he didn't give him permission to use it, and Neil Young supports Bernie Sanders.
Wow.
So, okay. You have the right to marry someone of the same gender because the Supreme Court and Obama says so. And anyone who disagrees can go fuck themselves. And those are my freedom rules for today.
Wait, that's it? Let me fade it out.
Okay, those are my freedom rules.
All right.
You think we should do that again next episode?
No. Okay. Make them funnier.
All right. So, time now for my new favorite segment. It's called Low Stakes Cereal.
So, drum roll, please.
Michael, what is the subject of Low Stakes Cereal? Just read it out to me there.
Why are the bathroom doors in public schools being locked? Conspiracy alert. This is something hairy.
That I want to investigate this, and I want to change this, because the 99%, you know, we have
can we get Barra on this for a second?
He can get his mic on.
I can get his mic on. Barra's going to join us in this conversation. Barra, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Michael.
Yeah, you featured, of course, on the Talks About Tech weekly finale. Thank you very much for joining us.
You're ever so welcome. The 10-month weekly period.
Yes. And you were a fantastic in-studio audience member. So,
so you're here to talk to us about our low-stakes cereal.
I mean, because we all, everyone in this room, except for you, goes to the same school.
And so I go to the jazz.
And the problem, the problem that we want to address, we want your sort of outside perspective on it. Bathroom doors are being locked in a public school. Now, public schools are places that people have to go to because
they're public.
Going to a school is compulsory in this country. Now, if I go to school,
I don't have a choice. I have to go to school.
Exactly. Now, if I go to school, I expect a certain standard of comfort.
Well, here's the awkward thing. It's not exactly going to be an outside view because the toilets in my school have also been locked at periods before.
Oh, there you go. This is not just our school.
No.
This is a national problem.
Okay, now,
You heard it first on this show.
This is a fact. I'm not making this up. This is a fact. It is a breach of the law. It is a breach of guidelines by the Irish National Teachers Union. It is a breach of both of these things to lock bathroom doors in a school with over a certain number of students.
It must be human rights.
It's also a breach of human rights.
Do you know how many bathrooms you need for...
I think it's...
One bathroom for how many students?
So, in our school, the male student count is somewhere around, I don't know, 425, I'd like to say, of male students.
Per one toilet.
No, I'd say that's a total of male students. No, I'm saying there'd probably have to be one toilet, toilet open per 300, maybe?
I'd say less
for 250.
Yeah,
and yet there's only one toilet open because they lock one.
Right.
And the toilet that is open, they don't. They all. It's also remains locked at break time.
Yeah,
at least
like,
2 days a week.
So, there's times when I've had nosebleeds.
Yeah.
I've had to run out of the class, like my nose is dripping blood.
Yeah, and you've had to go to the absolute far end. It is literally upstairs at the end of a long hallway at the very, very far end of the school building. That is the only one accessible.
Shane is coming in the conversation.
Study, which is a bit awkward, ran out upstairs to the bathroom. No toilet paper.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Well, that's a
second. There was toilet paper lying beside the urinals. I actually used that. It wasn't used. It was like a stack about this thick, and I took some from the middle, and was like, "This will do. This is clean."
That's happened to me so many times.
It's
a secondary issue.
John Tierney and Kieran Jordan just sitting outside, not in study.
Secondary issue to the fact that the bathroom doors
they just
are being
don't
locked.
Go to the first hour,
and bathroom doors are being locked, and this is a serious health and safety concern.
Okay, for most of us, but in fairness, some people do not use the bathrooms correctly and abuse them. And
not an excuse. They should be monitored then.
Oh, God, yeah. A campaign should be
put forward to combat that. Now, on May 20...
The reasons the bathrooms were locked in my school are, like, beyond, like, vile and disgusting. I won't go into detail.
You see, because there was no reason in our school.
Feces in more places than urinals.
We were not made aware of any particular event which led to this occurring. It just began to happen. And the doors on May 22nd, Friday, May 22nd, the doors were boarded up. I got a photo of this. The doors were boarded
single
up.
Single 1-inch by 12-inch.
It was
plank.
Disgraceful.
Wow.
Screwed.
Now, 4x12 by...
Now, young. There are young people in the school who, you know, need
access, and they've requested access from certain members of staff. Members of staff have denied them access with no legitimate excuse, and it is my mission to use this forum to change this, and we want to get things changed. So I just want to put this out there. If you agree with me that bathroom doors should not be locked in schools, we want you to tweet using the hashtag no locky the doors.
Free the poo.
I mean, Lucian is very, very
I'm very passionate about this.
Me, not so much, because I'm going to be out of the school in a year. I don't give a crap.
See, yeah. Lucian,
pardon the pun. credit to Barry Comfrey for providing those sound effects.
So tweet hashtag no locky the doors. So that's NOLOCKY the doors, no locky the doors, and we're going to get things changed.
If anybody does that, I swear to God, you have no life.
So Michael.
I agree.
Michael.
Yes.
What's up next?
This
podcast seems like 3 hours long.
Bye.
We're going to have some public service announcements from Lucian. What's your second name?
Collins. What
is it? No, your middle name.
Benjamin. Oh no, it's Saul. Yeah.
Saul. Lucian Saul.
Wadili. Michael, turn up the music.
Music is coming on.
So, Donald Trump announced 2 weeks ago, these are public service announcements. Donald Trump announced 2 weeks ago that he's actually running for president. His announcement was surrounded by controversy. From his awkward entrance on a slow-moving escalator to his hiring of movie extras to cheer him on for just $50, and a feud that has begun between Trump and Neil Young following Trump's use of Keep On Rockin' at the event without Young's permission. Young confirmed that he supports Bernie Sanders for president, while Trump got confused since he shouts Neil Young at his servants on a daily basis. People immediately began looking at Trump's Twitter feed for commentary to mock. He was found to have expressed a strong opinion a few years ago on the breakup of Twilight stars Kristen Stewart and Robert Pattinson. Pattinson, of course, is best known for playing Edward Cullen in the Twilight films. Ah, Donald Trump and Edward Cullen, one sex-crazed 114-year-old vampire with pale skin and amazing hair who preys on young women and hunts wild animals to quench his thirst. The other is Edward Cullen from the Twilight books. Any applause for that? Jeb Bush is also running for president. Thank you. Next up, Jeb Bush is also running for president. We suspect he'll use guerrilla marketing to promote his campaign, such as having members of his staff hiding in bushes and assaulting passersby as they shout, "Hey, I'm the Bush monster. Vote Jeb."
Maybe he should. He should look at doing some advertisements on podcasts.
Maybe
such
he
as this one. Of oh course, no.
Of course, Jeb isn't using his surname, which has become associated with genocide, corruption, and evil over the past 30 years, and has chosen to replace the Bush name with a suspicious exclamation mark. Coincidentally, a straight vertical line is exactly how Jeb's older brother used to sign bills into law when he was president. Jeb Bush is a quite untrustworthy person. Jeb isn't even his real name. His name is John Ellis Bush.
Oh,
Jeb,
really?
Jeb Bush, seriously. Jeb's two sons are called George Bush and John Bush. His son John is known to friends as Jebby Bush. Could this get any worse? Jeb also has a grandson called John William Bush and a granddaughter called Georgia Bush. So in theory, within the space of like just a few decades, we could have U.S. presidents George H.W. Bush, George W. Bush, Jeb Bush, Jebby Bush, John Bush, and Georgia Bush. Will this family ever stop breeding? Jeb Bush, our current preoccupation, of course, thinks he's pretty cool. He lets people know he thinks he's cool by riding a Segway, because only someone who knows they aren't cool and knows nobody thinks they're cool, but wants others to think that they think they're cool, rides a Segway. On June 26th, the U.S. finally got blanket gay marriage legally across all 50 states. In unrelated news, Republican Lindsey Graham is no longer the first bachelor presidential candidate. The Westboro Baptist Church were too busy...
You have to research Lindsey Graham. It's not homophobic for me to say that. It's, like, just a fact.
Oh, okay.
The Westboro Baptist Church were too busy picketing the funerals of the Charleston victims, completely irrelevant to homosexual affairs, to notice when the Supreme Court announced their verdict on gay marriage. For several hours, you've got to be pretty stupid to be otherwise engaged when the decision your entire life has been dedicated to discouraging is confirmed because you're too busy telling innocent black churchgoers that gay marriage is a sin. Of course, the legalization and social acceptance of homosexuality alone makes the WBC have a tantrum. Marriage doesn't even factor into the equation. The WBC don't understand the concept of marriage, sadly, because marrying your sister is against the law. Yeah, Westboro Baptist Church. Man can lie with man, but man cannot lie with womb mate. And those are our public service announcements.
I'm going to
for July
that.
3rd. So, Michael, there what's next?
I think we're going to wrap it up.
Is that really it for episode one?
That's
of
really it. It's like super long. It's like
So, Michael, thank you for allowing us
Lucien,
to record in your studio
thank
today.
You for coming along and doing this with me. It's been great.
I hope people enjoy this episode. I hope that they will give us the benefit of the doubt that we will only improve.
Contact either Lucien or Michael if you manage to sit
here. So, The 99% is a co-production of Carb Digital and BuzzHub Entertainment. You can get your websites designed and hosted for great prices with great professional design.
Wow, you're doing a plug for me.
At carbdigital.com.
God, do I have to do a BuzzHub ad now for you?
Yes, you do.
BuzzHub is the place to go for all of your culture, movies, reviews from top reviewers from around the world.
Like we some of our viewers, Jerry Collins Jr.,
right?
Nick Harris.
Phil Brindolo, of course, features on
yeah,
there.
Benji Stickers.
And
Michael McAndrew reviewed Men in Black 3.
I did. I reviewed that a while back. And
you could read that review now.
I don't want to read that review because I'm afraid what I said on that review.
So visit buzzhub.info for that. You can visit 99pshow.com for the latest episodes and be sure to subscribe.
That website, by the way, it was designed by myself and
absolutely.
Lucien.
And, oh no, designed by Michael.
And Lucien.
Designed by Michael.
Yeah, mostly by me.
But, Michael also produced our fantastic promo for the show, our video promo, which is absolutely fantastic.
You can
watch
it around the web.
On our website, on our YouTube channel, or Facebook page. You can find links to all of our social media outlets at 99pshow.com. You can subscribe to us on iTunes, on Stitcher.
Yeah. Stitcher, kill my family.
Or on
don't
our
look that up.
Or on your favorite podcasting app. Follow us on Twitter. We are at 99pshow. And on Instagram, 99pshow.
Follow me on Twitter, TalksAboutTech1.
And Revolutionary. Thanks to everybody for tuning in. Thanks to Graham Smith, Shane Kelly, and Barra Convery. We will be at our studio audience, Kevin McAndrew and Owen Dobie. We'll be back next week with episode 2 of the 99%.
Adios, amigos.